This conference will now be recorded.
All right, it's Monday, March 3rd, 2014. This is a reading Odyssey discussion of Virgil's Aeneid. We're reading the translation by Sarah Rudin, and we're discussing books 4, 5, and 6. All right, so before we jump into talking about Dido and Aeneas, let me just ask the general question. What were some of your favorite passages? Were there any phrases or verses that you particularly liked in any of these three books? And Kendall, I know you're using your halls there, but I thought I might ask you first. Was there anything that you particularly liked in the reading?
What did I particularly like? I continue to just love this translation. I don't think I picked out anything in particular, but I love what she's done with all of this. I don't know. My big takeaway from the reading this time is just what a complete cad Aeneas is.
Yeah.
It's a word I hadn't even thought of for years, and just, that's what he is.
You know, you're right, Kendall, he is.
Hold that thought, because I really want to get into Dido and Aeneas and what happened there. And in a word, I agree. I guess it's two words. But before we do that, let's talk, any other general impressions or favorite passages?
I have a favorite.
Go ahead.
I think that's Nancy.
Yeah.
Okay, Nancy. Yeah. I'll call on you, and then I'll find out who else was talking. Okay.
So, were you asking? I'm sorry. I just joined. I couldn't find the right phone number. So, are we going through favorite passages and lines?
Yes.
Okay. So, I have one initial favorite line. That's any bold boxers with their rawhide thongs can step up. That's kind of a joke. But that is a real line, and I thought it was kind of interesting. But in seriousness, a passage I really liked, and I'll read it the way I thought of it. It's a little bit long, but it's about 10 lines.
Tell us where it is so we can follow.
It's page 85.
Okay,
right after the break.
Right, okay.
So now it was night, and all Earth's weary creatures slept peacefully. The woods and savage waters were still. The stars were halfway through their journeys above the tranquil fields. Cattle and bright birds of the broad lakes and brambly wilderness all lay asleep beneath the noiseless sky, their troubles soothed, their sufferings forgotten. But not the desolate Phoenician queen. Her heart and eyes shunned darkness in the ease of sleep. Her torments thronged, her love ran wild. They came and went on seething tides of madness. Her heart was churning with unceasing questions. So I love that, because to me that was just, the peacefulness of the world and the interior psychological torments. And I thought it was a really amazing setup and contrast.
Yeah, that's a great selection.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Who was that saying that?
That was Elizabeth. I marked that passage also. I don't know if it's my favorite passage, but I marked it as I wrote beautiful, because it really is.
Yeah.
It brings you there.
What was a favorite passage of yours, Elizabeth?
Oh, I don't know if I have a favorite passage. There's two that I'm sorry, I'm breaking the rules, but there's two that I kind of marked just because I found them so strange. The one where he, let's see if I can find it. The one where the poet speaks again in his own voice on page 125 at the top. where he's going into the underworld, and it's around line 265, and he says, give holy sanction, let me pass this tale on and open what deep earth and darkness cover. So I thought, oh, that sort of brings you back to the beginning when you have the poet speaking.
Mm. That's a great point.
And then the other one is where when Iris disguises herself as a woman to encourage everyone the other women to burn the ships.
Uh-huh. So that was
I thought that was hilarious. The idea of a god coming down and that expert meddler. You know,
yeah.
Among the Trojan mothers, and then someone else says, "Well, you know, no, she's in bed, homesick." I mean, the idea that there are these, phonies among us. I like that. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a funny scene, but that whole idea is funny.
Yeah.
So this is Sean. I'll go to what I thought was actually a funny scene, which was 127 around line, I guess it's 340. And just the whole story of Palinurus and kind of the, hey, dude, what happened? You were supposed to make it with us to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, how did the gods hate you? And he's like, oh, no, I just kind of fell off the boat, you know, swam to shore, everything was great, and then these bastards came along and killed me. I just thought that was funny somehow. I was actually sitting next to my wife. I started laughing, and she's like, what the hell's going on?
that's true. I didn't laugh out loud, but I see what you're saying. It is kind of funny.
He made it all the way to Italy. Some tribe killed him.
Yeah. This is great. I love it. I love learning what passages I take so much away from this. What else? Anyone?
I like on it's Frank on page 75 just the description of rumor, which starts
rumor.
Right after
the
break.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. Rumor, the swiftest plague there is, went straight out to all the settlements of Libya. She thrived on motion, drawing strength from travel, teeny and timid first, and shooting upward to hide her head in the clouds, yet walk on ground. And it goes on, and I thought that was a really nice description of rumor. I could really feel it.
Yeah. And you know, rumor was a goddess called Fama in ancient Rome. I think I had forgotten that. That's the history of our understanding of that concept. And I love this description there. It is like one of the best descriptions of rumor I think that has ever been written.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're so right, Frank. Cool. What else?
Phil, the passage I liked was over on page 141. And
okay.
It's sort of one of these ironic ironies that he brings out. He spins lines, 825 through 840, 45, describing the future at that time of Rome's wars of conquest. And then he ends the passage that says, but Romans, don't forget that world dominion is your great craft. Peace and then peaceful custom, sparing the conquered, striking down the haughty.
Yes. Yes. I had called that out as well. But we're going to talk, I hope, a lot about these final pages of book six, where Aeneas is obviously speaking directly to the Romans. Without very much with directness. I mean, the page before, at the top of 140, it's line 793 or so, we discover that Augustus Caesar is down there. The soul that's going to become Augustus Caesar anyway, who happens to be the guy who commissioned the writing of this of this whole tale.
No self-dealing.
Good. Who was that speaking? Was that Alan? I'm trying to learn voices. Or was that Mark? Who was that brought up this piece in page 141.
I brought it up. This is Alan.
Alan, I thought it was you. Okay. All right, great. All right, good. Mark, what about you?
Alan's was my first choice as well. And I thought it was actually almost a capstone to the three chapters we read. But if you go to page 138 before, I like the description of, you know, when they're seeing the souls floating around as to what happens when they actually have to go up into bodies. And he goes, and yet the noxious body slows them somewhat. The earthly parts that perish make them numb. Those parts bring fear, desire, joy, and sorrow. Souls in dark dungeons cannot see the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite
what happens when you
too.
From Elysium and have to go back in these terrible bodies we have to inhabit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of my favorite language is also on that page. Let's see, what line is it? Let me have this underlined. Where is it? Sorry, hang on just a second. But somewhere on this page, oh, here it is, on page 770, line 775, I should underline that. The famous names of places nameless now. Whew! I love that line. The famous names of places nameless now. Mm. And then later, of course, renowned Rome, or maybe that was up ahead, I don't know, because I have these notes in the margins. Renowned Rome will rule the world and raise her heart to heaven. Okay. All right. Okay, I get it. We'll come back to that. All right. So let's see. Who else? Who haven't we heard from? Jill, what about you?
A Soul's Journey was definitely one of my favorite passages as well. And then I really liked the passage in book six on page 125 from like 270 to 280 when they describe sickness, old age, fear, hunger, poverty, and as if they're people or gods or whatever they were. And I really loved that. Near the Fury's iron rooms, crazed discord lives there. There's just some great descriptives of things we don't normally think of as entities, you know?
Yes.
I thought that was great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is Josh. That was actually my passage as well, and I thought that was interesting for me because it was somewhat different in terms of how it represented the underworld versus what I remembered from the Odyssey, where the underworld was a little more neutral, and this takes a much more negative, gives a much more negative, dark impression of the underworld than it seemed Homer had.
There's more depth here, isn't there?
A lot more.
There's just much more dimensionality to Hades, not to mention many synonyms used to describe Hades and the rivers and lakes in Hades. I don't know if you guys were flipping back and forth between the glossary and this section while you were reading through here, but I certainly was. In fact, I ended up making a lot of footnotes in the actual text so I could follow along. Well, yeah. I also love this description, and I just want to read the language in one of the areas here. As by the stingy moon's cloud-crowded light, people walk in the woods when Jove has shadowed the sky and color hides beneath black night. Woof! Oh, great language. Oh, my God. Sarah. I know it's Virgil, too, but Sarah has done an amazing job here. All right, who else?
This is Bill. The underworld passage. What's interesting is it is a lot different from Homer, but it really, you can see the influence, how close it is to the Christian view of heaven and hell and heaven both. You know, I mean, this is it is very little distance from this description to the Christian view, which is, you know, clearly from the time of Homer, a view of heaven and hell evolved that was not, you know, in Homer, you know, the underworld was not a punishment, you know, and this
right.
is a punishment. I do have to say, right. although I like everything everyone's citing, even the journey of the souls, the prophecy of the future Romans was pretty pathetic. I mean, just so such pathetic propaganda was, I mean, honestly, it was the most disappointing part of the book so far.
No, it was not.
Oh,
I liked
yes, it.
It
was.
I liked
it.
Okay,
oh, I thought it was just
listen, we're going to get into this. We're going to get into this fight in a little while, okay? I will respect the fight. We'll get into it. But there's another fight we need to have first, which is, or at least a discussion, which is Dido and Aeneas. But before we do that, I want to see if there are any other favorite passages.
Well,
we haven't. I don't think we've heard
one of my
yeah.
one of my favorite passages. It goes back to Dido and
yes.
it's on page 72.
Yes.
Why didn't you reach out to me?
Flame devoured her tender marrow. Her heart's wound throbbed
yeah.
in hiding. Soon Dido burned and raved all through the city, as when a deer is wounded from far off by a shepherd who is not aware his arrow has found its mark. Through Dictae's
yeah.
woods the quarry runs, and the death reed buried in her side. And I think
yeah.
that's a pretty important passage, and it's also, you know, there's a lot going on in that too, and a lot of the imagery is important, the flame and the arrow, the hunting.
Yeah. I love that. And
also, echoes much later, you know, with the suicide, all the same
yeah.
fire in the city. So it's obviously quite poetic.
Very, yeah, and I loved, so I underlined that her heart's wound throbbed in hiding, which I love the language and the image. And also, if you look on line 55, just the second line of that same page, the phrase lent hope to hesitation. Oof, love that. I never thought about that before. I love that. All right, good. Let's see, we have a few more people to hear from. We've heard, I think, Lisa, Frank, Sean, Mark, Alan, Jill, Kendall, Josh, Scott, did we hear from you?
I think a lot of the stuff I thought of is already been identified. One thing that struck me is it's not exactly funny, but I liked it, was when he's describing Tartarus at the top of page 134.
Yeah.
And the word Tartarus appears on the previous page, and it says, then plunges twice as far beneath the shades as if you look towards heavenly Olympus, which means, I guess, that hell is twice as deep as heaven is high. And that just seemed like a very Virgilian kind of note.
So slow down so we can all follow you. What line is it on 134?
Sorry, on page 134, the very top two lines on the page. And it's talking
yes.
about Tartarus, which,
yes.
and it says, then right. plunges twice as far beneath the shades as the view up towards heavenly Olympus, which I
yes.
guess means that hell is twice as deep as heaven, is twice as big as heaven, or twice as deep as heaven is high.
That's great.
And I just thought that was the sort of, that's
yeah.
Virgil for you.
Yeah. All right, I've got an email from Pat. With a passage that he really liked. I'm waiting for it to load. Let's see. I know this page is a bunch of people's favorites, he says in his email, but this part particularly struck me. Lines 290 to 294. Aeneas snatched his sword in sudden terror and held it up against the shapes approaching. Had not his shrewd guide said these flitting things were flimsy forms, illusions without bodies, he would have rushed to stable them to no purpose. Stab them to no purpose, yeah. I love the alliteration of it, Pat says, but also he captures something about the nature of our fears. They are indeed flitting forms and capable of being stabbed into non-existence. Ah, terrific, Pat. Love it. Great way to read that passage. Okay. All right, great. All right, let's see. Bruce Upton, we've not heard from you, right?
Yeah, yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I had Frank took my rumor one too, but I have have another one on page 122 in book 6.
Yeah.
It's a poetry. It's line 179. So Aeneas just comes back from a meeting with Sybil, the prophetess, and she helped him get the golden bough, and that one of your men will be dead and you need to bury him. So they go, they're trudging away from the cave, emotionally distraught that one of their men is dead, they didn't even know. And Mycenas, so they have to go off into the woods. So they went into the old woods, deep beast shelter. Pines toppled, holm oaks echoed to the axe. Wedges split beams of ash and fissile oak and giant mountain ash rolled down the slope.
Yeah. I had called out that hidden oaks echoed to the axe, or holm oaks, yeah. Excuse me, echoed to the axe. I just...
That's good stuff.
I love the language of that. That's great. All right, good. Thank you, Bruce. All right, so let's talk about Dido and Aeneas. So Kendall, let's go back to you. It sounds like you have a point of view.
You know me, Phil. I always have a point of view.
So Kendall, is Dido responsible for her own misfortune, or what's happening here?
Well, is she responsible for? I think she has to take some responsibility for her actions, despite the meddling of the gods and goddesses. But I just think Aeneas's behavior is so hideous. In the way he tries to sneak away and all of that, and there's just nothing very sympathetic about the way his actions are portrayed, I think. This whole, gosh, I have to, get off and found this empire and the place I'm supposed to found this empire it just doesn't seem that believable and compelling.
So let me ask you something, Kendall, and I want to hear what other people think, but let me be Aeneas's advocate for a moment, even if I'm perhaps not completely on the side of this, but there are passages where Aeneas, both in book 4 and later in book 6, is clearly quite sad to, he feels he's been told by the gods what he needs to do, and he's sad and distraught. Is it his fault here? What's the caddish behavior you speak of?
To me, the caddish behavior that isn't explained is the trying to sort of sneak away. Just seems so strange to me and so dishonorable.
The caddish behavior is, I never made a pact of marriage with you. That's line 339 on page 80. If fate would let me live the life I chose, if I had power over my decisions, but just that not considering, their union to be what she did and real. But he says he's powerless.
Who is this speaking? Is that Lisa?
It's Lisa.
Okay.
And then on the next page, we get Virgil, saying, well, right thinking Aeneas.
Yes.
And he's described as deeply lovesick, and I believe he was, but I still don't think he was anywhere near as deeply lovesick as Dido.
Do we detect in Aeneas something of protesting too much here? His words sound familiar. They seem like the words many men have used over many generations to explain their not taking real responsibility for their actions. Is that part of what you're picking up on?
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, this is Elizabeth. I really read it very differently.
Yeah, how did you read it, Elizabeth?
Well, you know, for some reason, Venus is playing this horrid trick on Dido, not explained why. It makes no sense whatever. But, you know, Dido falls insanely in love with Aeneas. And then when he is ordered to go on the ship, he has this dream that Dido is going to attack and burn his ships, which, of course, Dido is also thinking about.
Right.
So it doesn't really seem crazy to me that...
That
I
he's
mean,
trying to sneak away?
Yeah, because she's not, you know, a girlfriend or something who's betrayed, who, you know, if he only talked to her and they could talk it over and then she'd feel better. I know she's someone who has armies and people and she's very, very angry. And she's planning to... destroy him. She has a lot of vengeful feelings. So I don't really see it as, I mean, of course my sympathies are 100% with Dido, but I don't see him as a cat at all.
But speaking of crazy, what do we people think about Dido's madness? Because it she is described over and over again as this being a madness. And it wasn't convincing to me in her behavior or actions that she was mad, other than, you know, madly in love, so to speak. But on the other hand, Phil, to your point about what generations of men have said, I mean, is Dido's madness there to really give Aeneas the foolproof excuse, not just of gods? It's like he snuck away because, God, this woman is insane. I better sneak away, right? I really dodged a bullet here. It turns out this wonderful babe is crazy. I mean, so talk about things men have said for years, but the question is Virgil setting up that excuse that this woman had gone was crazy.
Yeah, but just in okay, I'm gonna.
Is that like my super girlfriend or something like that?
Yeah. Don't forget, she's not just lovesick. She also. Her honor has been compromised because she's broken a promise. She's broken the promise to her dead husband. So you know, there's a lot more riding on this than, you know, her infatuation.
Oh, I would agree. My question though is the whole question of trying to portray her as crazy, Virgil's way of giving Aeneas a further excuse for his cattishness. She's not just a stalker girlfriend, but it was that sort of the image that Virgil's trying to create.
Well, let's ask the group your question, Bruce. I think it's a good one. Are people convinced of Dido's madness? What, other than her being described as mad, what actually is the content of her madness? What are the actions she's taken that constitute such madness?
Well, she kills herself.
I think there is that.
That seems post-facto reasoning, but okay.
It's almost like it's this outside force. This hot madness drives me. You know, it's almost like, I mean, I read a lot of these passages that these are things she is also not in control.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading in the Arthurian tales, there's some maiden who's pining away for the love of Sir Lancelot and she's dying and a monk says, you know, you should be thinking about heaven and not Sir Lancelot. She says, I'm an earthly woman. God made me an earthly woman. I can't help it. Mm-hmm. And I think Dido's just an earthly woman. I mean, she's been bearing the burden of being a king, of being a monarch in a strange, alien, and fairly hostile environment.
Mm-hmm.
She misses, I think she misses being with a man. And, you know, I think Virgil's treatment of her is very pitying and almost subversively so, and you really feel bad for her.
But I think, you know, Aeneas, she's a queen, as I think Elizabeth pointed out. I mean, she's not, it's not just like a crazy girlfriend. She could ruin everything. And Aeneas does have this, you know, divine task to go found a civilization in Italy.
From my perspective, I think that's the key thing. The passage, the setting up the relationship and the real humanizing of Dido here and the sadness he's setting up, it's making it so it's very hard for Aeneas to leave. He has to make a real choice here.
Right.
It's not, oh, here's a chick I've been sleeping with. Should I go to Italy or should I stay here? You know, this is something that's obviously a very, very difficult decision for him to make. And it's important that it's a difficult decision because he does ultimately choose his destiny to go to Italy over this woman who he obviously loves and who obviously is very passionate about him.
I actually took this whole passage a little bit differently, because if you go through before we got here, you know, they really had to be beaten back to get all their way back to Carthage. And remembering that this is the founding myth of Rome, I took this whole thing as them setting up that it wasn't really about Aeneas and Dido. This was about Rome and Carthage.
Right.
And what they're doing is they're setting up this deep multi-generational animosity between, you know, this is why Rome is always fated to go back to destroy Carthage, because Carthage is is inconsolate and will never be, you know, will never be satisfied, will always be angry at Rome and will never be satisfied.
They're crazy. Right. Those Carthaginians are crazy in their hatred of Rome.
Let's look at line 380 in book 4, page 81, 380. She says, this is the key moment. I will not cling to you or contradict you. Ride windy waves to chase Italian kingdoms. I hope that heaven's conscience has the power to trap you in the rocks and force your penance down your throat as you call my name. I'll send my black flames there. When cold death draws my soul out, my ghost will hound you. Even among dead souls in hell, I'll know when you are finally paying.
Woof. I think she really forgives him in that passage.
What's that?
I don't think she really forgives him in that passage.
I guess that's a curse down through the generations that means that Carthage and Rome can never be at peace. And it is I read somewhere that, of course, the last queen of Carthage, you know, when Carthage finally lost to Rome, committed suicide. So there's some, I think obviously this is about Rome and Carthage. I mean, that is so very clear. But there's also something quite sad and frankly unsettling to me, at least as a 21st century reader, to read the setup in the relationship between Dido and Aeneas. And I think, you know, in the first pages of book 4, we have her sister pleading with her to essentially break her promise to her husband and to enter into this relationship. Will you let, on line 32, will you let lonely grief devour your whole youth without sweet children and the gifts of Venus? And then this is one of my favorite passages. Do you think ashes care or ghosts in graveyards? Poof. And then goes on from there. Really pleads with her sister. And then, you know, Aeneas, Virgil goes on to say on the top of page 73 that sickness gripped the queen who let her folly outrun her good name. So whoever made the point, maybe it was Elizabeth or Nancy, I forget, that yes, she had broken a promise to her dead husband. Maybe that was Kendall. That's true, but there's something poignant, sad, and I don't like it. I feel like Dido is being blamed. And the whole thing, I think we need to rewrite this.
Well, listen, Alan, I would agree with you wholeheartedly, because to me, this is sort of like setting up the archetypal woman versus a man, because we look at Dido, if you go over to line 569, where Virgil says, "Be quick and go, a woman is a changing and fitful thing."
I hated that line. That line just riled me up. Yeah.
Dido is, false, passionately love, gives up her duties and responsibility as a leader. And then you set this up against Aeneas, who comes across as, "I'm just a dutiful man following my faith and doing my highest duty."
Right. Right. It's almost like original sin, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, wait, slow down. So isn't he doing his duty?
Oh, Aeneas?
Did you say duty?
Yes. Very mature.
Aeneas is
doing what he's supposed to be doing.
Yes.
Well,
and
he is.
She didn't do what she was supposed to do.
That's right.
So
Aeneas is doing the common good.
Right, but did we need to set it up this way, Sean? We could have Aeneas doing his duty, but without all the baggage of, basically feeling sorry for the lovesick Aeneas being chased by the mad woman who then commits suicide because he doesn't stay with her. I don't like that arc.
Like Odysseus and Calypso more?
Say that again?
Did you like Odysseus and Calypso more? That was sort of an amicable breakup. After the woman distracted the hero from his mission for 10 years, she allowed him to go on his way.
Yeah, well, I did. I like that better.
I think part of what Virgil's trying to do is kind of say, here's the hero of Rome, and he's taking civic duty over his own personal feelings. And I think maybe that was just kind of a message that he was trying to reinforce. He has a chance to marry this powerful queen, and, she has all these great things, but duty comes first. That's probably part of the underlying message there.
That's very true. Okay.
I actually viewed books 4 and 5 as something of a pair, because what they're doing is they're setting us up into who are the people who are going to move on and eventually land in Italy, and what, who are these people who are left? Because I actually thought book 5 was actually a very important book, because it goes through the whole process of winnowing out people as to who is the nature of the people who will finally make that, the final landing in Italy. And also what is, I think the baggage they carry is part of it. And again, I don't think it's about Dido. I think it's about the fate that they carry, because it wasn't, Dido did not fall in love with Aeneas. Dido was made to fall in love with Aeneas. And this is, again, back to, this is all the fate. These people were always, the Romans were fated to have, the hardy survivors of this voyage, and to have this baggage that they had accumulated from the fall of Troy, and always to carry that with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to acknowledge that's a good point about the role of book 5. And we may be coming to the end of our discussion of Dido and Aeneas and able to move on. Pat sent in a note, but before I share that, somebody was about to speak. Who was that?
Yeah, this is Alan. I just wanted to go back and look at the role of fate in this, because even Dido, as she gives her swan song, says, "I lived, I ran the race that fate allotted. I'll send the underworld a noble ghost." So, I mean, even she, I think, Virgil's putting her mouth that fate controls everything here.
Yeah. I know, but the thing is, and we also have lines like 569, "Be quick and go, a woman is a changing and fitful thing." which seems to throw fate out the window and relate to this as a woman's problem. And it's ambivalent. You know.
Well, then when you get to book six, you have the you have people's being judged in the underworld for their actions on Earth, and you got to say, well, geez, if fate rules everything, how can you judge somebody for their actions?
Right. Well, let's hold that thought.
This is Nancy, and I think it's always challenging to read something centuries after it was written, and all. And I think what I'm amazed by is the love story aspect of this, because I don't know of other. I mean, I feel like there is such depth and a human connection here. You know, the Greek myths, it's sort of more, you know, almost like sexual, like this person raped that person or this person. And I think, you know, the sort of companionship that they feel and the depth of it, I mean, it's, to me, that is really a very interesting literary invention. It feels, you know, it's a little bit soap opera-ish, but it sort of sets the foundation for so many other stories like that. So I find that very interesting in the context of a story that's kind of an epic founding of a nation story.
It's very clearly, though, a parallel with what was in the Odyssey, though, with Calypso and Odysseus.
Yeah.
There's definitely very, very similar themes in terms of the hero on his way to his mission and then being sort of sidetracked by the female figure who, in the Odyssey too, he had a 10-year relationship, I believe it was, with Calypso.
Mm-hmm.
A connection.
But Josh, I think what Nancy's saying, and I feel like it's given me a greater understanding of what's going on here. Moving away from some of, you know, it's helping me see something I think I wasn't fully appreciating, which is in the Odyssey, yes, that's true. Calypso's in the cave with, you know, or Odysseus is with Calypso and there for a while. But you don't, the emotionality is not as well developed.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I hear Nancy saying.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful,
the depth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A beautiful book, I mean.
Yeah. And, you know, John Maricola, who's one of our board members and a professor at Florida State, and he edited the edition of the original Penguin edition, not the original edition we read 7 years ago or so now. His wife, whose name I'm momentarily forgetting, actually specializes on emotion in antiquity. And mm-hmm. it strikes me, Nancy, we might reach out to her and ask her
mm-hmm.
about these passages and the comment that you've given here. And how does she see that in terms of development of emotionality, at least as reflected in the art and literature? That's
right.
Cool.
And that was the passage that I had read. What I loved about that passage was the contrast between the external landscape and the interior psychological life. I mean, to me, that was just astonishing. That he goes on and on about the peace that was everywhere, and the cows were peaceful, and the birds were peaceful, and the stars were peaceful, and the land was peaceful, the sheep were peaceful, everything was peaceful. But Dido, in her head, was tormented. I mean, she could have chosen to be peaceful. She could have looked around and decided to quote unquote breathe. But but she was tormented, and I feel like that is a fascinating, you know, understanding or invention of the world of the mind and the depth of it, emotionality.
Yeah. All right, so Pat's got a couple of comments here that I need to read to y'all. First, on the context for the line, the woman is a fitful and changing thing. He says, remember, this comes out of the mouth of Mercury when he's trying to roust Aeneas to get in his ship and go. Good point. Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Pat goes on to say, it's not clear that this amounts to editorializing about all women on the part of Virgil. It's a thing blurted out to goad someone into action. And then he goes on to say, I think something that is agreeing with you, Nancy, I just think Virgil presents a much fuller picture of Dido than this. Also, it comes out of the mouth of one of the gods, and as we've seen in both Greek and Roman works, gods don't come off too well. They're unreliable themselves, amoral, and given to pettiness and manipulativeness. The ancient Greeks and Romans themselves would probably agree with this assessment of the gods. He also said, and I'll just share this, that I think Dido's under a great deal of political pressure. She already was on thin ground with her constituents, being a foreign ruler who ascended the throne by the murder of her husband. She feels she's got no real options to resume ruling her country. No wonder she's suicidal and mad. She really doesn't have many options. It's a good political assessment, I think. Helpful.
Yeah.
Helpful dimension. All right. Good. Are we ready to move on?
Yeah, I'll just say one other person I think about in all of this. It's like Medea and Jason.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That other story, and just the awfulness of, you know, like giving your love to some guy who then like off he goes, and you
yeah.
know, the you know, drastic steps
yeah.
one
yeah.
might take after that. So somebody somewhere, I'm sure, has written about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll say one more thing unrelated to the Dido-Aeneas conversation, which is on page 87, line 601. And what was the context here? Who's speaking? I think this is Dido speaking. Am I right? I think this is Dido speaking. And she says, I could have scattered the... Okay, she's talking about what she could have done to, you know... She could have, like, you know, killed all of his people. And I could have killed his friends, his son, and made a banquet for the father. Do you remember in the first book of Herodotus where, who was it? I should have pulled it out. One of the Persian, early Persian kings, you know, has, let's see, I think what happens is he punishes one of his lieutenants by killing that man's son, unbeknownst to that man, and then serving it to him at dinner. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I thought, all right. So the difference between Homer and Virgil is that Virgil has the benefit of Herodotus, among other things, before he writes his epic, as well as Homer himself. So I saw that Herodotus echo, and I thought I'd bring that up.
Mm.
Okay.
That's also from Greek tragedy. It's also from Aeschylus as well.
Oh, of course, yes, Aeschylus.
The Agamemnon story.
Yes, yeah. Probably more in the minds of everyone than Herodotus, I would think. Okay, so book five. Let's just spend a moment here because I think we're 5 to 9, and I want to spend the last 15 minutes or so really talking about book six. So who was it that was making the comment about book five being an important bridge? Was that... Mark or Alan?
I actually made the comment, not that necessarily it was a bridge, but I just thought that was
that
they were
Scott?
Great paired together, because it told you how that final group was formed and what was the nature of these people who would end up being the founders of Rome.
Great. Say a little bit more about that. I'm gonna just call in, and then we're gonna move on to book six. So you be our expert guide to book five.
You have your golden branch. I'll guide you.
All right, so keep going. So what was it that determined the group that was going to go to Rome?
Well, I mean, I thought it was interesting in the contests, you know, what type, you know, how these contests are setting you up for the people who were there. It was and I thought one of the best parts of it was the ship race, obviously, which I think even among the contests was kind of the centerpiece.
Yeah.
You had the two captains who were... wouldn't take enough risk when they made the turn. Then you had the guy who was too foolhardy. He would take too much risk. The man who won was the one who took risks, but not foolhardy risks, right?
Yeah.
And he was the one who was the number, you know, who was the one who won the race. You know, they go through who wins these contests, and it ends up with the drill, which was not a necessary contest, but I think there's a passage, I don't have... right in front of me, explicitly, is that these things come straight from Troy, and this is going to be Troy's gift, because all these young men, the one who are ones who are the best. Yeah. These are the young men who are going to go with them, you know, after the, you know, the chapter ends by saying, well, you know, if the people don't really want to go, the weak, the infirm, the ones who really don't want to keep fighting, you can stay. The ones who want to keep fighting will go. And so there's a winnowing process going on in that chapter. You know, it's taking them down to, these are the true heroes. And among those heroes are the people who are the most daring, the smartest. And also, they're carrying with them the skills that they learned straight from Troy. So, again, the Romans are looking back and saying, you know, we didn't invent all this stuff. We are the descendants of the military of Troy, and we have kept all these, they gave these things to us. And hence we created the legions and we conquered, you know, as much of the known world as we could. So I just thought it was a wonderful chapter setting us up to this final group that's going to be landing and going to be the actual founders of Rome.
Yeah. And let me ask you, so I think you're right. And I'll just ask you one quick question and we'll move to book six. Line 709 and 710 on page 111, since we've discussed fate, what do you think?
Staying or going?
Staying or going, we must follow fate. Whatever comes, endurance conquers fortune.
Yeah.
What are we being told here?
Well, I mean, what they're saying, I mean, it's fortune. I mean, if you take fortune as all the things that have occurred to him, the winds going against them, you know, Neptune has been made angry. All these things that have kept them, you know, the fall of Troy, all these things kept them. That, if that's fortune, you know, they say endurance conquers, and that's saying, you know, here's the time. You know, we have an opportunity to get back in the boats one last time and go. And those people who want to conquer their fortune, and it's just, and again, that I think it does go back in some ways to book four, is at the end, what do we do is we have a fate, you know, the gods have said there is this fate, you know, we're gonna be letting down future generations if we don't do this, and so what we need to do is keep getting back in the boats and going.
You know, I have a problem understanding fate. And maybe in the next call we can try to tackle it, because there's fate, but there also seems to be some level of choice preserved, and this has a very Christian, you know, element to it, which I've never quite understood, the idea of prescribed destiny, but then somehow choice. But let's leave that and let's move to book six. So, all right. So who would like to? Who would like to walk us through what's going on here? So it sounds like we might have a Bill. Let me call on you, since I think you were so provocatively saying you didn't so much like, especially the end of book six, which you felt was, you know, just uncensored propaganda, something like that. I have to say, well, I think that was true. I also, it was very cool. It, you know, when I realized that Virgil was speaking directly to the Romans, there was something that I quite liked about it. But tell me what you thought.
Well, I think I already did. I mean, the description of hell is wonderful. More interesting than the description of heaven, which is usually the case. No, I just
and
thought
heaven,
it was
heaven being Elysium, I assume.
Yes.
Right.
You know, I just thought once Dad starts, you know, rattling off the great names in Roman history, and you know, leading up to the wonderful Augustus, it just has the taste of craven propaganda, you know, to the. You know, I don't know. I mean, it just.
Well, let's go to page 134, Bill. So let's start with the first part of your comment that you thought the description of hell was more interesting than that of heaven. So at the bottom of page 134, we have what are clearly some moral lessons for the Romans. But where, and it might be a little, where, what do you like?
about the description of hell?
I don't know, the viscera growing back. The moral lessons are interesting. Those who crouched alone on newfound riches, the largest crowd.
What does that mean right there, by the way? Do you think he's saying if most people crouch alone on newfound riches, that's what he means by the largest crowd in parentheses?
Yeah, I think he's saying that's the biggest group of sinners. So the nouveau riche, there's too many of them. You know, if you tie it back to chapter 5, where, you know, I think what we were discussing is, I mean, chapter 5 is basically justifying the domination of the patrician clans, right? So they deserve what they have, but these merchants and the nouveau riche and probably the freed slaves who aren't generous like old money is, they're the ones who fill up hell. Anyways, that's how I read it.
Good political read, I think. All right. Well, what did other people think about the description of hell here? Or Hades, should we perhaps say?
Yes.
One thing that I loved about this chapter, actually, was I loved learning. I don't know about you, but I actually didn't know I more carefully read this chapter, and I really learned all the various names and synonyms for Hades and its rivers and lakes and mountains. And I kind of like that, actually. I don't know if other people did or if you found yourself annoyed with having to keep looking at the glossary, or if you didn't, maybe you just plowed through. But what was your experience of reading this? Anyone? Let's see. Kendall, have we heard from you in the last few? What did you think about these pages?
Haven't finished this book. Just started it.
Yeah.
Reminded me so much of Dante, which I know the other way. I mean, I know it's the other way around, but Dante is taking Virgil, but...
Yes. Alan Davis wanted to talk about Dante. Alan, you want to say a few words now?
Sure. When I read this in the way that I saw great connections between Dante, but then I went back and looked at...
Dido's in Dante, right?
Pardon me?
Dido is in Dante in the second circle.
Yes, he is. So's Virgil, so's Homer, and a whole bunch of other people. And oh, by the way, he does have at the bottom of hell is Ulysses and the rest of the Greek heroes.
I like Ulysses. I just want to go on record. And in our next call, Frank Rensler is going to talk to us about how different cultures have treated Ulysses over the generations. But keep going.
Yeah, I was surprised, by the way, that Virgil did not seem to encounter Ulysses in hell. He mentions him, but he doesn't see him.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't see any of the Greeks because they all run away when they see Virgil.
I guess so.
Well, Ulysses is probably not dead when this takes place.
Ah, good point.
Yeah, that's a good point.
He's still
Well, no. We on page 132. Let's see, where is this? We have a reference.
Yes, 526.
Yeah.
So where's that?
There's a reference to Ulysses killing Deiphobus.
Yeah, he's not
being behind.
But not saying that he's dead.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
Which is the hatred of him is just right there.
God, pay the Greeks back. Yeah, no, you're right. Ulysses is not dead yet. Yeah. Okay. Keep going, Alan. Sorry.
That's okay. But I just saw great parallels between the way Virgil lays out begins to lay out the layers of hell and having judgment done down there I forget the name of the god, to what Dante writes almost 1,200 years later. I mean, it's almost like Dante extracts from Virgil, uses Virgil as the guide to go through limbo, hell, and purgatory. Mm-hmm. And then it's, you know, I traced it back, and it, when it go, you go all the way back to the Odyssey, where Ulysses visits the underground. And there's also a judgment factor in people that are laid out in particular order in severity of crime. The other connection I thought was interesting, Dante puts at the bottom portrayers of kin, guests, benefactors, and country. And those are the same people, same types of sins are at the bottom that Virgil puts at the bottom.
Now, poor Alan asked me over email if we could read Dante here. You know, and I said, yes, we will read Dante. I think we were about 10 years away from that. hang with us, Alan. We'll get to it. But you see...
but it's interesting. I went back and I dug through my Inferno. A lot of the imagery and language that you see in the Aeneid as translated here, you'll find when you get to that point in a decade when you read the Dante's Paradise.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that people who read Dante in school should at least read Book 6 of Virgil. it's really quite amazing. All right, so let's talk about, as our final point here, these final pages. Okay, so we know Bill's response, and it's a fair and valid point. And I guess we can start at the page 139. And who is this that's talking? And he drew the two guests in the middle. He climbed a ridge. This is Anchises. He says, "Come hear your destiny and the future glory of the stock of Dardanus, all the descendants that we will have from the Italian race, great souls who will be born into our family." And then he kind of, and this is the beginning of the reading of the names. And I have to remember, for those of us who read the Old Testament together, remember the names? The names and names and names and names. It was in one of the first books of the Torah.
Yep.
And I remember that. I remember thinking, why are these names so important? And it just keeps coming up. And I felt like we were doing another reading of the names here. Under this, this man saw renowned Rome will rule the world and raise her heart to heaven. Blessed in her sons with seven citadels, the seven hills of Rome, in one wall, like the tower crown great mother driving her chariot through Phrygian cities, holding in blissful arms her 100 grandsons from gods, all gods themselves who live in heaven. Now turn your eyes, see this clan, your Romans, Caesar, and all of Julius's offspring, destined to make their ways to heaven's splendid heights. Here is the man so often promised you. Here is your savior, Augustus Caesar, a godson and bringer of a new age of gold to Saturn's old realm of Latium. He will take our rule past India. And it goes on. And then we get to that line that someone shared at the beginning at the bottom of page 41. Romans, don't forget that world dominion is your great craft. Peace and then peaceful customs, sparing the conquered, which is true. The Romans made citizens of, you know, the elite of the conquered, and, you know, they didn't wipe them out like they did the Carthaginians. Striking down the haughty. I thought that was very interesting. Really? That's our moral mission, is that we go around and we bring peace, we spare the conquered, and we strike down the haughty. Okay. And they were amazed. So I couldn't believe that Augustus Caesar's name was in here. I mean, that felt like over the top propaganda to me. I have to agree with Bill on that. I was going along with it up to that point. You know, it's like, I mean, can you imagine someone writing an epic poem today and, I don't know, Ronald Reagan or Barack Obama's name being called out? I mean, people would like recoil. But that doesn't seem to have been the response in Rome. I don't know for sure, actually, and I'm interested to know.
Hey, Phil? Phil?
What's that?
This is Josh. You know, when I read this part and I thought about the mention of Augustus Caesar, I recently read another book about North Korea and how North Korea sees itself and how it's positioned the North Korean leadership. And there were a lot of parallels in that they created this, they both have these myths that go back a couple thousand years about, you know, the Korean people and what their destiny is as a people. And then they sort of massaged all these myths anew to sort of fit the new leadership of North Korea, the Kim Jong, you know, and, you know, how they position the leaders as sort of the godlike centerpieces within the context of ancient myths. And I don't know of anything else in the modern world that's really close to as parallel as that. But this North Korean book definitely resonated with me in this context.
Well, what you're saying reminds me of what Nancy said earlier, I thought, you know, in terms of the trying to read something that's 2,500 years old or so. I guess in this case, a couple thousand years old, not quite 2,500.
You know, Augustus was the first Roman emperor to rule as a god.
Yes.
So he had put himself, and he did that by having Caesar declared a god after Caesar was dead, and then said, "Well, if I'm his nephew, I must be a god too." So
right.
You know, he ruled that
way. And his
way.
Adopted
so
son.
I wasn't that
son.
Surprised to see him there. I would almost been surprised to not see him aggrandized that way.
Yeah. Well, good point. Yeah. All right, well, maybe we can finish our conversation and ease our way to bed by talking about the final passages of this book. Can someone explain the two gates of sleep? At the top of page 143. What are these two gates of sleep?
As I understand it, the sort of the thing that puzzles everybody is that it's the dream. The gate of ivory is the gate of false dreams, and that's the one that they go through. And so everyone sort of like trying to figure out what Virgil meant by that.
Yeah.
That was a bad point.
Well, two gates of sleep. I mean, sorry for my, you know, I didn't really understand this. Does that mean two gates where you enter sleep? Because that's what I'm reading it as.
Yeah, it's part of it. I have to say I'm not totally clear on this passage either, which is why I'm asking for some help here. I think it means something like that, but also something about the quality of the dreams, whether they're true or false. Right? And then it is confusing to me that the ivory gate where the false dreams go up toward the sky is the gate that Sybil sends them through. So what the frick is that supposed to mean?
It's been suggested that that's supposed to mean that Virgil's sort of undermining this. He's sort of saying, yes, this is all propaganda I've just been telling you.
But what does it mean to have the spirits or the false dreams go up toward the sky? Does that mean they're floating away? Or does that mean they're coming into the light and they're going to have some effect on us, even though they're false? I mean...
Yeah, I don't know. And what does it mean to say that true shades go out there easily?
Right.
Of the horn? What does that mean? What's a shade?
Well, you're going out first of all, you're going out into sleep. Meaning
well, shade is often used to mean like a soul, so maybe they mean maybe they, you know, and of course, in this case specifically, they're talking about two beings that aren't shades at all, namely Aeneas and Deiphobia, whatever her name is.
Well, I mean, are they coming back to wake up, or are they going to sleep?
I think they're coming back they're coming back to the world.
The gate of sleep is a gate where you leave sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you were
I think we need our best legal minds to parse this.
Well,
Elizabeth, Scott, Nancy.
Well, okay, you're going out of sleep, and if you're a true spirit, then you go out of come to you. You come back to, you wake up easily, all right? And the other, you go out of that, and then you have false dreams up to the sky, where or toward the sky, anyway.
So do you have another translation of this passage?
Oh, you know, I do. I have one right here. Hold on. Hold on a second. This is read my college translation by C. Day Lewis. All right, where are we? okay. Here we go. Does anybody want to hear this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here we go, the end of book six, in a different translation. There are two gates of sleep. The one is made, it's the same. The one is made of horn, they say, and affords the outlet for genuine apparitions. The other's a gate of brightly shining ivory. This way the shades send up to earth false dreams that impose upon us. Talking then of such matters, Anchises escorted his son and the Sibyl as far as the ivory gate and sent them through it.
Hmm. Well, listen to this in the Odyssey. So this is interesting. Penelope, in book 19, has a dream that seems to signify that her husband Odysseus is about to return. Expressed by a play on words, her conviction that the dream is false. She says, "Stranger, dreams verily are baffling and unclear of meaning, and in no wise do they find fulfillment in all things for men. For two are the gates of shadowy dreams, and one is fashioned of horn and one of ivory. Those dreams that pass through the gate of sawn ivory deceive men, bringing words that find no fulfillment. But those that come forth through the gate of polished horn bring true issues to pass when any mortal sees them. But in my case, it was not from thence, methinks, that my strange dream came." So that's clearly what he's brought. And Socrates, Plato in the dialogue Charmides, Socrates says, "Listen then, I said, to my dream to see whether it comes through horn or through ivory." And then, of course, Virgil uses it, but he sends, Aeneas up through the one that gives dreams that deceive men. There's just no other way to see it, I think.
Right.
Why? Yeah, but Aeneas is not a dream and not a spirit, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's very mysterious.
Yeah.
It may be something that we'll just understand as we get further into the book. I don't know if I completely understand it as it stands alone here.
Well, if you read further down the Wikipedia article, they're stumped too. Because it says, it's uncertain why he did it. Although they point, one theory is that it refers to the time of night at which he returned. But there's also the view that, what we call reality is not such that Virgil may have considered the Platonic world to be the real world.
Ah, right, that he's passing through the gate of ivory to go back to the, quote, real world because it's not the real world.
Yeah.
Right.
Because that makes reality sense. Is not real.
Yeah, there may be some cosmology that we're missing. Some theory is when they talk about the firmament and all of that you can't understand it unless you understand some other things.
I'm sorry, just one brief point. Supposedly Virgil read books 2, 4, and 6 aloud to Augustus. so I don't think
in their entirety. So I don't think he would have. I doubt he would have put in something that just completely undermined everything he just said at the end of book six.
Yeah.
The emperor.
I wonder why he chose
maybe
book
it's
six
a joke.
To read to Augustus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's a joke. Yeah. All right. Well, this has been a great conversation, guys. Thanks so much. And I don't think Kristen's on the phone with us, but I want to thank her again. She's doing great work in keeping us organized.
She sure
is. Yeah, so she deserves our support and applause. We do have an event coming up on May 14th that I want you guys to put into your calendars. Excuse me, it's not May 14th. I speak wrongly. I think it's May 21st. Let me check. We're going to have a webinar with Paul Cartledge and Jamie Rahm. Oh, no, it is May 14th. I'm sorry. I was right. We'll send you a link to sign up for it. It's Paul Cartledge from Cambridge is someone many of you have met, and Jamie Rahm from Bard College are both involved with new translations of Herodotus. So we're going to have a salon, if you will, talking about Herodotus and these new translations, and it should be a lot of fun. It's May 14th at what time is it? 7 o'clock, I think, Frank. We have to do it a little bit earlier because poor Paul is calling in from Cambridge. So hopefully that's the time you can make, Frank.
Could I ask a question? You've already read Herodotus together, right?
We have, but we're going to do it again.
Oh, good, because I took out Herodotus as well, and I just thought, okay, good, great.
This fall, I'm looking for a moderator to run a Herodotus reading group. And frankly, this session in May, in part, will be, I'm going to try to stir up some interest to get people signed up to do that. So this group that's reading now, Virgil, will not be the group reading Herodotus. We'll be reading something else, but we will have a group reading Herodotus. Mm-hmm. And you may want to join that. I can't recommend it enough. I've done it twice, and I have to tell you, the second time is even better than the first. I just can't believe. And, you know, Bob Strassler, who was originally a military historian, and his first landmark book was Thucydides, and that's, you know, Thucydides is the, you know, pinnacle of the military historian. He was the first and is the archetype for that. And Bob thought Thucydides the better historian than Herodotus. He then did Herodotus in the landmark edition. And to his great surprise and to my delight, he finished that project thinking Herodotus actually the better historian and the better writer, which is a quite a big thing for someone who's steeped in military history to believe, since Herodotus does almost no military history in that book, it turns out. Anyway, I can't recommend that enough, Elizabeth.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so it's 9:25. Guys, thank you so much. What a great conversation. I really appreciate we have really strong attendance. We're going to meet again in about a month, and we're going to tackle the next three books. And Kristen will send out reminders, and she'll send out some reading questions, and we'll hopefully have another great conversation.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you,
everyone.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great
night.
Evening. Okay. Bye-bye.